welcome to Cinemakers, Steven Soderbergh. This is episode 21, Che from 2008. I am Tobin Addington.
I'm Mike Manzi.
And I'm Joey Lewandowski. And guys, I've got to tell you, for 4.5 hours worth of movies, the fact that I have one page of notes is, I don't know, troubling?
I have 2 pages. I don't know if that makes any difference.
I have like my usual amount for the first part, and then for Che part two, I've got like 1/2 page.
I was talking to Mike in the green room. I didn't really want to talk too much about this. I was trying to think of like how to describe this movie, and I think it's an example of a movie that's like one of the movies that's the strongest in this category, where it's like really well done, and I have absolutely no interest in ever like seeing it again or thinking about it again.
It's not your typical biopic. I'll give it that. We'll get into how the story's told and how different part one is from part two and their similarities and all that. But I also feel like this is like more of, it felt almost more like a docudrama at times. And Joey, I think you mentioned to me at one point, like you kind of wish maybe this was just a documentary, or that Soderbergh had made more documentaries. And I almost agree with you on that point.
I feel like, and I don't mean to cut off Tobin from his initial impressions, but I feel like this is the kind of movie where you're supposed to be entertained on some level, but also like learn on some level. You know what I mean? Like, oh, this is sort of a history of Cuba and Bolivia and Mexico, and this is Ernesto Guevara and all this different stuff. And I'm like, well, like my brain doesn't learn from this kind of movie. I wish it was just like a straight up documentary. And it's disappointing to me that the only documentaries that we're going to have really in Soderbergh's career are the Spalding Gray ones, because I really feel like if he cared about it, if he wanted to do like a documentary, I think he would really kill it. Like, I think he would be great at it. I guess considering he does, I don't know, literally every other kind of movie, I guess he just has no interest in doing a documentary. I don't know.
Yeah, you know, as soon as we make a guess about what he does or doesn't like to do, he'll prove us wrong. So who knows what's in our future. But this movie is clearly not interested in teaching you about Che. Like, if you don't know, and I've never seen this movie before, and I feel like if you don't know who these historical figures are that he's surrounding himself with or that he's surrounded by, then the movie doesn't give you that context, right? Like,
Not at all.
You come into it, you probably know Fidel Castro, and you probably know Raul as his brother, and that's about as far as I knew. I mean, I don't have a deep knowledge base about Che beyond the fact that he's on a bunch of t-shirts and that he was a revolutionary. You know, like that's kind of as much as I knew coming in. The movie tells you really early, I think, that it's not going to explain anything to you, that it's just sort of jumping into events. But then what he does is he jumbles time, right? He jumbles time and film stock, and it's almost like kind of kaleidoscopic, right? Like a person looking back on their life in some way. And as we'll talk about the two, when they broke it into two movies, Che Part 1, Che Part 2, they are very different and in some ways. But neither one of them gives you any kind of traditional narrative history of these characters and what they're doing. And in some ways, that I found that kind of exciting. Like you're thrown in. You know, like I appreciate not having my intelligence insulted, but I don't know that it makes for a very
compelling,
enjoyable movie watching experience. If you're not sometimes it feels a little bit like if you don't know these characters, then you're kind of dumb. The movie's telling you you're maybe a little, not dumb, but you're uninformed, right? Like the movie's kind of saying, get informed so you understand the movie. And sometimes that works. And I felt a little bit out of it in this one.
Especially, I think, toward the end of the second one, where like everybody not only has a name, but also a nickname. And then like Che isn't even going by Che, he's going by Ramon. I'm like, I already don't know who anybody is. Why are you like adding names on names? Like, I really have no idea who anybody is. Like, I know who Benicio del Toro is, and I know who Damien Bashir is, and I know who Matt Damon is. Hi, Matt Damon in part 2. Yeah. Other than that, I have no idea who any of these people are, real or fiction, like actors or characters or based on real people or whatever. Why does this feel like homework?
I recognize Lou Diamond Phillips in there in part 2 at one point also, so I felt like I earned points for that. But I agree with you totally. Like, the first movie kept my attention and kept me interested because of the time jumps. You know, he goes from meeting Castro and then going to Cuba and like becoming guerrillas, and then they sort of flash forward to him speaking in the United Nations in New York City and being interviewed for television. And that helps me jumping back and forth in time to stay entertained, and it keeps my attention. And I'm with this movie, and I actually enjoyed the first one very much. But neither of these feel very much like your typical American film, like the structure-wise and anything like that. And the fact that they're 100% in a foreign language. I mean, it feels like a film made by a foreign filmmaker. I'm actually surprised at times that this is Steven Soderbergh making this movie. I mean, I know it's him because he's got the stamina to pull this off, right. And I see some, yes, of, like, you know, what he can do with the camera and this and that and everything, but it doesn't feel like a Steven Soderbergh movie at a lot of times also. It's not like the Johnny Cash movie where, like, you're going to learn everything about his entire life and anything. You need to sort of come a little more prepared. I wasn't more prepared, but this was my second viewing. And I will say, though, I might not have learned, like, a lot about Che per se, but I feel like I understand why people... Like, I feel like he was beloved. Maybe we'll get more into it, but I understand Che at the end of this a little better, as opposed to having no idea what he was about beforehand.
Well, I like that title, Che per se. Can we use that
yes,
for something?
That's great.
I think I really actively pretty dislike biopics, because I feel like too often they try to cover too much time, and even if it's, like, you know, closer to 3 hours than two or whatever, it's hard to fit a life, especially someone important enough who did enough to warrant a biopic, into that time frame. That's why I think movies like, recently I can think of, like, Selma, mm-hmm, which is about a single event, work better. It's like, I mean, it's not really a biopic, but it kind of sort of is in a way. I think that works better because you can cover a single event, whether it's like a week or whatever, in a movie. Here, it's close to that, but in the second one, it's what, like, over a year, right? It's a single event. I mean, the event is a revolution, or, you know, an attempt at a revolution,
right.
But, like, it's so all-encompassing, like, it's so widespread and so long in duration that it's, like, it's one event, but it's almost like a mini-series. I mean, right now, as we're recording this, Ken Burns' Vietnam just started, and, like, I feel like this revolution could warrant an 18-hour mini-series instead of, like, a 2-hour and 14-minute movie. Like, it feels like, again, sort of like there's so much to cover, but also at the same time, like, kind of not? Like, I don't know.
Yeah, I think you're totally right. Either of you guys know the movie Carlos? I guess it was 2010.
Yeah. Carlos the Jackal?
Yeah, yeah. This is Olivia Assayas, who recently made Personal Shopper, this French filmmaker.
Oh, I love that.
It was originally made for French television, I think, a miniseries about Carlos the Jackal, which played here as a 5-hour movie. And he's a filmmaker who has in the past, there's a film of his called Irma Vep, which is even more kind of experimental in places than this movie. But, and so he takes a somewhat similar sort of tack on, you know, exploring the sort of rise and fall of an infamous, in that case, in the Carlos Jackal case, an infamous terrorist, and not revolutionary necessarily, I guess, depending on your point of view. But he sort of takes a sprawling, vaguely experimental look at his life. I think it's much more successful as a film. It does give you more context, and it feels like the scenes play a little bit more as drama and a little less as kind of docudrama, if that makes sense. I can track him a little bit better. And yet, in my mind, that felt like what this was trying to do. And I don't know if that's fair to what Soderbergh had set out to do. But and Edgar Ramirez, who plays the main character in that, is in this as one of the revolutionaries in part one. It's an interesting connection to make. But if you haven't seen Carlos, there's a Criterion edition of it, and I would urge you to check it out if you're at all sort of interested in a non-biopic in the way that this is.
Just mentioning quickly Criterion, like, I bought the Criterion Blu-ray for this, which is one of the thicker ones because it's the two discs. And unlike a lot of the other Soderbergh movies that I don't really like, I'm not ashamed to have this on my shelf because I think it's, like, a beautiful movie. It's a really nice package. It's not like The Good German, which I can't wait to get rid of. You know what I mean? I appreciate this movie, and I'm not against watching it again, but it was so daunting. And I realized that in our collective vow, especially me and Mike, to just watch less bad things and watch, you know, more good things, really. The amount of podcasts that we do, like, even if we don't watch stuff like that on our own time, there is no way that I would ever watch Che. Like, I would never watch this movie just by choice, I don't think. So I think that just, like, staring at this 4.5 hours of movie, I'm like, oh, God. And I had to spread it out. Like, it was, like, Saturday and a little bit of Saturday night and, like, Sunday morning. I was just like, I just got to get through this.
See, I don't know if I did the right thing, whereas I sat down, I watched it all in one day. I took an hour and a half or 2 hour break in between to have lunch, and then I sat down and did it. But I almost wonder if that led to some kind of fatigue on my half, because I just feel like part two is... is too long. Like, it's too much of the same. Unless that is the point, you know, is that, like, he was out there lost in the jungle of Bolivia for a year.
It's a slog for him, too.
Yeah, but I mean, like, the thing I did like about part two was the title cards of the day number. And it's like, if you're going to do that, then you can skip a couple extra days. I mean, I almost wanted at the end of this to be just a 3.5 hour, one part movie where everything is just combined together somehow in some way. If we get like a Soderbergh special cut, maybe I'll write to him and see if he's up for the task or if he'll let me do it.
Knowing him, he's probably already done it. It's like on his website for us to watch.
So, I mean, I just think from like an entertainment value aspect, it's just too long. You know, Apollo 13, I could have an extra hour of that movie and we could go more into those astronauts' backstories. You know, let's take an extra hour before they launch. But that's multiple people. And, you know, I wish we just had more interaction with, like, Castro, because that guy's great. Whoever's playing him is killing it. And again, maybe that's the point, is that he wasn't having these deep personal relationships with the leaders, and he was more down in the dirt with the peasants and stuff. But I also don't feel him and us growing any closer to them either. We get a lot of trekking through the forest, and it's done really well, but I don't feel like that like deep sort of like emotional connection.
You know what I was reminded of while watching this movie, Mike? I think it's a perfect parallel for a lot of reasons. Nymphomaniac.
Okay, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Because that's another really long movie that was split into two parts for easier digestion that we had to cover for a podcast. But I think I'd rather rewatch that than this, like, pretty readily too.
It covers way more of that person's life, even though it's a fictional person. We're covering her life from like a child to like an adult, and Che only lives to be about 39-40, so it's even stranger that his biopic is longer for having lived sort of a short life.
And I also think that Nymphomaniac works better because it's so broken down into chapters, which I think, like you were saying, you know, the reason that part two is as, not, like, bearable is the wrong word, but, like, sort of bearable is that you have those day title cards. You say, like, oh, okay, now we're 6 months later or whatever. I also want to point out that, like, you know that someone's going to die in a biopic when the day card also has a specific date on it, like both in this movie and also in American Sniper. Like, I didn't know that the American Sniper, Chris Kyle, died, but when they put a card on, and this is, I guess it's a spoiler, but like it happened in real life, so I don't know, you can't spoil real life. But when they put the date on screen, I was like, oh, he's about to die. And like, I didn't know that, but like, why else would you call attention to a specific date like they do in this movie or like they do in that movie unless someone was gonna die?
Now, let me play devil's advocate just for a little bit on these two issues, the length and those title cards. And I don't know that I fully believe it, but let me try. I think there is something to the cumulative power of this film. There's something about the you know, it's going and you're watching it, and it's these various styles he's using to shoot and the film stocks he's using. It's all kind of vaguely disorienting and a little dizzying. But somehow, for me anyway, it had kind of a cumulative power. Like, 2 hours into this 4.5 hour thing, I really was because I didn't know what happened to him later in his life. And I assumed he didn't live to be an old man, because I think we would have heard of him more recently, right? So, you know, I sense that it's not going to end well, but I'm kind of with it at that point. And I'm, you know, there's a sequence at the end of, a long sequence at the end of the first movie where is it Santa Clara they're taking? They're sort of taking over the final push of the revolution in Cuba. And I thought there was some really powerful stuff. I was clicked into the movie at that point as much as I was in the whole thing. We seem to be combining the sort of, no pun intended, guerrilla style filmmaking with the I know with the beautiful imagery, with the sort of these life and death stakes. And by then I knew who some of the characters were, and you know, it's hard for them, but it's going well, and they're breaking through that church to get into the wherever they're trying to get to. And you know, I don't fully understand everything that's going on, but I don't think I need to at that point. The stakes are very clear. And then the second movie, everything that went right in the first is going wrong in the second. You know, there are all these scenes where they were achieving some sort of surprising military victories that were easier than they thought in the first movie, and none of them work out in the second movie. And Che, who was sort of, even though he had his asthma and that was sort of slowing him down in the first movie, is really increasingly physically, you know, disabled by illness and eventually gunshots and things in the second movie. And you just feel like this idea that, like, revolution revolution is a young man's game. He didn't have the youth and vitality that he had in the first revolution and should have stopped. Like, it's very clear he should have, you know, in terms of his own life, preserving his own life. So there's that. The other thing I wanted to say, adding into that, the title cards and the I think we are meant to feel that drumbeat, that noose tightening at the end. Like, he is clearly not going to make it out of this movie. And when they put the date up, you're like, oh God, I know this is the date, but I don't know how. I don't know exactly where this bullet's going to come from, but I know it's going to come from somewhere. And I think Soderbergh smartly knows that he's not making a movie that, if you Google Che, you can find out how he died. So you're not going to be surprised that he's going to die. So in this case, it's like, oh, that's like the tombstone marker. And you're like, now the death is right around the corner. And I found that kind of effective.
What was surprising, I think, about his death is that we go into first-person point of view for the first time, I think, all movie, right? Like, I was just like, why is this happening? It was interesting, but I don't know the why behind it.
Yeah, maybe it was just to gain, you know, another perspective. I'm not sure.
We're kind of in Che's head for 4.5 hours, but we're also kind of not.
Right, we're observing him more, right? It's more observational.
Yeah.
There's a lot here to digest, and I'm always with it, you know, as long as I feel like it gets at times. Like, I'm never saying this is a bad or poorly made film. It's just my personal sort of feelings of it at that time. I'm sure if I just went back and watched part two on its own, I'd probably have like better feelings about it or better things to say. But one thing that did sort of strike me about it that I did enjoy, that I started getting into, is sort of, I'm going to mention two movies quickly that feel similar at times. One, because it's in Bolivia, is The Lost City of Z.
Oh, yeah.
And it's just that idea of man trying to, like, tackle the jungle and feel like, we'll hide out in nature and make it our home. It's like, no, the jungle is always going to get you in the end, some way or the other. So at one point in part two, I just started watching it as like a jungle movie, you know, like these explorers trying to find their way home. And then that sort of reminded me of like Valhalla Rising, finding your way home. And then the other movie I really struck a chord with was Fitzcarraldo by Herzog, you know, where it's basically Klaus Kinski trying to push a boat over a mountain for 2.5 hours. And just like the idea of a man with this impossible task, and maybe even sort of like a hint of madness has gotten to him at that point, you know? So I started finding like relations to other things that I started picking out of here thematically, I feel, were sort of connected that did keep me engaged. But again, that's like because I've seen those movies, they came to mind. And, you know, not everybody is, you know, I don't think it's going to trigger that with everybody either. So I found a way to turn it more enjoyable for myself.
That's such a great way to look at it, the sort of person in the jungle and the madness that ensues, right? The apocalypse now of it. And I think that's really a really sort of smart way to look at it. And the movie, you know, since it doesn't come to you and deliver Che's life, it asks you to come to it and sort of build the connections on your own and sort of do outside research. And I wonder if maybe, I don't know that I have the time right now in my life to do it, but, you know, to read the book it was based on, or the autobiography or whatever, you know, his writings that the movie says it was based on, and sort of educate oneself about Che and his life in this time, if it wouldn't resonate in an even deeper way. Like, he's going to hug somebody and say, hey, Ronaldo. And you're like, oh gosh, that's Ronaldo so-and-so who did such and such. And, you know, like, you can kind of bring your outside knowledge to it. I think it's a movie that asks you to do that in some ways. And if you haven't, it's, as you say, it's a beautifully shot. It's not a poorly made movie. It's just, I feel so outside of it so much. I feel so sort of distant from it. You know, it's a movie I admire more than enjoy, I think.
I wonder if any of that has to do with the fact that this was originally going to be a Terrence Malick movie, and then he dropped out when the funding dropped out, and then Soderbergh signed on. Like, the original screenplay was so long and it split into two, so it feels like there's like this complicated history with this particular production. And I wonder if it distances you from it because there were so many hands on it and so many different visions of it before it was actually made. I also kind of wish Terrence Malick made this.
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
That's amazing. Because
it'd be
amazing.
Like super dreamy and ethereal. I would just be okay with like 20-minute sequences of Che just like staring out into the jungle.
Yes.
Because like that's what would happen. That'd be cool.
Plus he's made Thin Red Line.
Right.
So like he could, you know, interpret battle and war in a cerebral way and something that would be maybe more visually sort of stimulating. Like, not that this isn't, you know, beautiful to watch, but like Terrence Malick has different set of tricks up his sleeve that could sort of get inside your head a little deeper. And, you know, visual hallucinations is the way he sort of sometimes his movies become like acid trips and things at times. So yeah, that would have been very interesting. And you can see maybe like little traces of stuff like that. I did notice from time to time, things just seem surreal in the jungle because of like modern convenience at times. Like there's one moment where they're all in the jungle and they're having tea and like the teapot and everything looks like so clean and perfect and like expensive and stuff. Just, it looked kind of surreal to me. I wish the movie had more of those contrasting images.
And also, while we're on the Terrence Malick note, and of particular interest to me and this podcast network and our new, one of our newest podcast, Boyfriend Material, apparently Benicio del Toro chose Ryan Gosling to play Benigno Benny Ramirez, and Gosling met with the real guy and learned some Spanish, but because the movie got delayed, he was forced to drop out. I would have loved to have seen Gosling in this movie, although if Gosling was this, that means I would have to watch it again for Boyfriend Material, and I'm okay without that. But aside from, you know, Lou Diamond Phillips, who you said, who apparently also, I read something that, like, he learned all this Spanish for the movie and then got on set and all of his lines had been changed. He had to learn all this, like, new Spanish instead. But, like, aside from him and Benicio and Damien Bashir, is there anybody else of, like, note on screen?
Oscar Isaac plays his interpreter when he's in New York. In like,
oh really?
Yeah, like
I didn't notice
that.
Three or
four scenes he has. Yeah, when he's at the UN, he's his English interpreter, and then Julia Ormond is conducting the interview with him, and she's someone. I think it's a famous interview. Again, I don't really know. This is just sort of from a little bit of Googling. I think it was a famous interview. I don't know the journalist that she's playing.
Gotcha.
But those two were the other two that I saw, or people that I knew.
Oh, just real quick, Oscar Isaac with another Ryan Gosling connection too, the standard to the driver. So another Boyfriend Material. I'm just so excited to do Boyfriend Material because we're recording this before it started, but now we're airing it while it's going on. So anyway.
While we're talking about the actors, I do want to call out by name the casting directors of this movie. I mean, they did an amazing job. This is top to bottom. I think these are great performances in a movie that, you know, where the performances really have to carry a lot since we're not being given a lot of context by the script, that the performances have to sort of, you sort of lives and dies by that. And there are three listed on IMDb. There's Rodrigo Belote, who's, I guess, a Bolivian casting director. And then J.C. Cantu and Mary Vernieu. Sorry for the pronunciations if you guys are listening to this. But I think that they deserve a round of applause because they cast it really well. And what a bear to cast. I mean, hundreds and hundreds of roles. A lot of them speaking roles. People come on for a minute and do two or three lines or have six scenes as an opposing colonel and then are gone. And they've built all kinds of backstory for themselves that you sort of understand intuitively or you should understand intuitively. Anyway, I think they did a remarkable job. We don't talk about casting directors enough, and I think that was a big job for this movie, and I think they did a nice one.
This movie has characters like Twin Peaks The Return, you know, like we'll get a scene in a sense that they're super important, but that'll be like their only scene. But one other guy that I noticed was, and I might have to apologize for this pronunciation, but Joaquin de Almeida, he was in Desperado as the bad guy, the Robert Rodriguez movie,
yes.
Desperado, and he plays the Bolivian president. So I recognized him and I thought that he was doing a really good job in the movie too.
I didn't think about this while watching. I wonder if, just thinking about it now, I kind of wish, like, Fred Armisen was in this. Because we know that Soderbergh's entering this, like, comedic era of his career in terms of who he casts. And I'm just thinking of Fred Armisen as the Bolivian president, I think, on that early Parks and Rec app where they're, like, sister cities.
Yes, yes.
And so just have Fred Armisen show up, even, like, in a serious role. Like, there's a character, well, you know, this is such an untimely reference as this airs, but, like, there's an actress in Mother that just shows up out of nowhere. You're like, oh, she's in this movie. But, like, it's just, like, a straight role. Like, it's not, like, a comedic role. You're like, oh, just to have Fred Armisen on this, I don't know, just make me entertain, be like, oh, look, there's Fred Armisen. Oh, he's just have four lines and he's just serious. Like, okay.
Well, I thought that's what was going to be going on in part two, was we were going to get a bunch of stunt casting because Matt Damon showed up and Lou Diamond Phillips showed up. And, you know, I started to actually be able to recognize faces in the second half, whereas in the first half, I just knew Del Toro, but got to love the guy who played Castro.
Wait, Damien Bashir,
yeah.
You mean?
Yeah, that's who.
Oh, okay.
But you've seen him in stuff.
Oh, I didn't recognize him as Castro, though. I mean,
yeah.
I feel like he just vanished into the role,
yeah.
Or at least like
he's
what
so
we know Castro to be. Like, he totally nailed how I thought he would act. You just get the sense that he was always on that way. And he was so different than Che. Like, their personalities, you know, they had the same sort of, like, they thought the same way, but they acted and reacted so differently. Even though Che was killing people and executing people, I get the sense that he just seemed like more gentle or more of like a gentle soul, or, you know, he was a doctor. He drove cross country before the movie starts. You know, he did the motorcycle diaries, like, you know, he drove cross country in a motorcycle, and has, maybe reading that would be insightful as well. Like, to see, you know, you go from being this free doctor studying and, you know, you have everything you want, and then you give all that up to go fight a revolution. That, just saying it, I feel the weight of it a little more discussing the movie.
It would be interesting to, for the movie to capture that, to sort of explore what makes that turn, you know, that we're, again, we're meant to bring, as I remember it, the first, maybe it's the first movie, the part one is bookended by those sorts of conversations. And then also isn't there a shot at the very, very end of the movie on him, with him on the boat on the way to Cuba? The movie is trying to tell us that that's such a pivotal moment. And I wish I could feel it a little more. This is where I think the Terrence Malick version would be pretty worth seeing. His use of that sort of floating philosophical voiceover of characters. Now, it probably wouldn't be Che who would be doing the voiceover. Like, it'd be some secondary character, you know, you'd be hearing all this stuff from. But it would give you, I think, access to their philosophy and their heart a little bit more than this movie would. Or at least their point of view, and a little less sort of docudrama. The danger with Soderbergh, for me, is often that he goes too cerebral, that it goes too clinical, that it's too cold. And I like his movies best when there's warmth in them as well. And I think that, you know, at his, for me, quote unquote, worst, that's where he tends. And this movie has moments of it where I do feel connected to the characters in a way that I think the movie wants me to. And other times, I just sort of feel a distance from it. And I think it might be a symptom a little bit of the kind of movies that he makes, and also the compressed time schedule they're on, right? Like, they shot this movie so fast.
Yeah, each half in 39 days,
I think. It's incredible. And under some adverse circumstances, and he says in the making of on the disc, Soderbergh does, in the Criterion edition, he talks about how the bond company, the insurance company for, you know, every time a movie is made, there's a company sort of takes out insurance on the movie. And they said that the insurance company, the bond company told him they would not grant the bond to any other filmmaker. They believed that Soderbergh and his team were the only ones who could pull off this movie in this schedule. Whoa. Given how ambitious it was. And he was shooting on red cameras, like brand new cameras that were like,
oh yeah, this was the first feature to be shot fully on a red camera. Yeah.
They finished the camera like 2 weeks before. Like, so there's all that kind of stuff weighs, I think, on the production as well. And if when the more context that I have for this movie, the more I appreciate it.
That's crazy that they basically field tested the red camera with this, making this movie. So like every shot you see was like, let's test the low light, let's test this in this extreme, let's see what the dynamic range is, you know, at this time of day. That's amazing. So you could just go back and watch this as from like, you know, a test reel of the red cam, and you know, every shot you see you can get from that camera.
Going back just a second to what Tobin said about, you know, the more context you have for this movie, the more impressive it is. I feel like that's sort of true of like everything he does. You know what I mean? Like, I really appreciate all these movies that Soderbergh makes, these different styles and these different approaches and these different circumstances or obstacles he has to overcome or whatever. I just don't always I feel like he's sometimes doing, like we said this before, like he's sort of doing it just to do it. But I feel like here, like, I wonder if he had a real passion for Che. Like, one thing that I read was that Benicio del Toro studied about Che for 7 years to prepare for this part. And I wonder, timeline-wise, Traffic was 8 years before this. So, like, I wonder if they talked on set of Traffic about Che, and then Benicio went off and, like, you know, started reading about it. Like, I don't know. I'm just wondering if, like, that works. I feel like this is another really impressive movie, just one that's in my sort of bottom half in terms of enjoyment, in terms of rewatching for him.
Yeah, when I think about him doing biopics, I mean, I guess the only other one he really did was, like, Aaron Brockovich, right? Is that pretty much it right. So far? Like, and that, like, I think we agree, like, that's the way to do a biopic, is, like, we're not learning about everything in her life. It's, like, the main incident, right? It's, like, the incident in her life that claimed the fame or whatever got her stability and made her famous, whatever it is. But, like, that's all we really focused on. Maybe the issue is that what made Chase so famous just, like, is walking through the jungle and, you know, fighting. And it's not, like, after a while, it's just what more are we learning except that he did a lot of this? You know what I'm saying? Like, I'm not trying to diminish that in any way whatsoever. Like, it's obviously like an impossible task. I wouldn't have lied. I'd been like one of those 14-year-olds when he's like, you could go if you want to be like, I'm out of here.
Yeah.
I'll take my backpack and I will go. Sure. Like, I'm not saying I could have done it or anything. I'm just saying as a film, it's just hard when you know that he can sort of bring out the life of a person through the film, you know, through a situation. I feel like he kind of lost it there in this one. Like, I'm not sure that I know Che. Like, I feel for Che by the end of this, but like, I'm not sure I know him any better. That he was a doctor, like, I never knew that. And it's just so like thrown away throughout the movie. It's like, I don't know. I just feel like maybe we needed a little more before he went on his revolution so we could have maybe felt the change more. I feel like he was almost at the beginning of the movie, he was sort of the same as he was at the end of the movie, because he was always so determined, you know, and idealistic. And I never really saw him before that. Like, I wanted to see sort of like why he decided, what was he like before that made him so different.
I wonder if that gets to something I wonder about this movie, that I hate to, I'm not wishing for a longer movie because I think that this movie is too long, but I wish for a movie that takes its time with some things a little more. Like, we skip through stuff so fast, which I think which is maybe why I liked that whole battle sequence at the end of part one, because I have time to understand what's going on and appreciate it and sort of keep track of who's up and who's down and what it means to the characters and who's going to make it to the end of this revolution.
And it's also like visually spectacular with the train derailment and stuff. Like, there's some of the bigger set pieces in that thing, which makes it even better.
Right, exactly. And I feel like, you know, if there was a little more time, if they weren't trying to cover, as you say, so much of his life, or sort of cover these beats in part two of this failed revolution in Bolivia, I think it might have been interesting to sort of spend a little more time with those human moments with him and get some sense of him as a person. It's just clearly not what he was interested in, but I think I might have been more interested in it. I see, Joey, as I look at our letter box, that we have this at the exact same place, number 13 and 14. We have different things sort of above and below it, but we ended up slotting it in the in the exact same place. And I think I completely agree with you guys. I think it's a well-made movie. I'm glad it was made. It is more interesting than some other things that we've seen, and more engaging than some of the other things we've seen. I just not engaging enough for me to, I think, probably watch it again. Certainly not anytime soon. I would pick up other things first. Any of those jungle movies that Mike mentioned, or Carlos, or something else, I would watch those things to sort of scratch this kind of itch before I would watch Che again. But I'm not opposed to watching it again. I think I would want more context for myself going in.
Would you want to watch it more or less if Val Kilmer was the lead?
Oh, wow.
Get out.
No way.
As Che?
So Benicio del Toro was always the first choice, but apparently Val Kilmer was like a distant number two, which is crazy to me.
That's insane. That can't be real.
Wow.
Both entries on IMDb for part one and part two said that. So either it's a lie, or someone is very committed to spreading that mistruth.
I could have seen Oscar Isaacs now, you know, knowing what a terrific actor he is now. But yeah, standing in, if like Benicio del Toro, you know what, like I couldn't see any way. Like, this almost feels like the role he was born to play, which makes it a little all the more sort of like bittersweet that it isn't, you know, better movie.
So this movie was, Benicio won the Best Actor at Cannes for this. This was nominated for the Palme d'Or. I did not realize it was nominated against 21 other movies, which I didn't know that this was a thing. 22 nominees. It lost to some movie called The Class, which I don't know,
yeah.
And I didn't look up.
French movie. It's great. It's really good. Yeah.
So that's that. It was also screened as a 4.5-hour movie over there, like in a single sitting, which it was screened in New York and L.A., that way to qualify for the Oscars, which it did not win any. I don't even think it was nominated for any Oscars. And then it became this sort of like traveling roadshow, and then it was released to DVD and Blu-ray and stuff like that. Surprisingly, I think, based on Mike and my reaction to this, the Rotten Tomatoes score for the second one is sort of significantly higher.
Really?
Than the first one. First one has 66%. Second one has fewer reviews, but it has an 80%. So I don't know, because I feel like the first one is more engaging. Like you said, Mike, I feel like it's more adventurous. I mean, maybe it's movie critics being self-deprecating and want to see the guy lose instead of seeing the guy win. I don't know, but it sort of caught me off guard.
Yeah, that first movie for me, again, definitely has more of what I'm talking about as far as, like, intimacy and getting to know Che. Like, we do get the interview with the reporter, right? And we get bits and pieces through translation of what he's fighting for, you know? But he also kind of seems kind of, like, arrogant at that point because he's won the revolution, so... And we also get times, moments in the field when new recruits are coming. Like, I feel like we get more of what I want and what I was talking about out of that first movie. In the second movie, it's less events. I don't know. There's just less to get into. So I am a little surprised that it has a higher rating.
I also can't figure out how much this movie actually made, because Box Office Mojo says it only made like $1.5 million. But then if you look on Wiki, it says it was a $58 million budget that made 41. So that seems like more of a real number to me than $1.5 million. But also, I don't...
That's international. As I understand it, $1.5 million is domestic.
Oh, because Box Office Mojo said like $1.5 million and then like 300,000 worldwide. So I don't know. There's something weird somewhere, but yeah.
Interesting. Yeah, I think if they made this today, they'd make it for TV, right? You know, and you could see that. You could see Benicio doing it these days. You know, heck, you could see Soderbergh doing it these days. And I wonder how different it would be if they, you know, had done today this way instead of that, you know, a different experiment for a different age, I guess.
That's all I got to say about Che, per se. Mike, anything else you want to say about Che?
There's sort of like the one thing we haven't talked about that Soderbergh does sort of like sneak into his films, or not even sneak into his, but sometimes his films are about the process, filmmaking process. And you can definitely, I feel, watch this from that perspective as well. You know, making a film is like going to war and you're on the battlefield. And I mean, I could have sworn at one point there was even a take where someone turned around and said, action, and like he left it in or something. But I do feel like it's a parallel in that regard as well. Like, you could watch this movie and be like, you know, not only was Soderbergh out there behind the camera shooting all this and orchestrating all of it, but it's also like he in a way is a figurehead in the sense that Che was, and that he is in charge of everything out there, and they're out there exposed, you know, like in the elements and everything. So I kind of like, I have not that, I mean, I had a lot of respect for Soderbergh prior, and, you know, just rewatching this movie and seeing it, and like, it's just incredible that like he didn't decide to retire after this, that this didn't break him. Like, I feel it would have broken so many other filmmakers. Like Coppola, like we mentioned Apocalypse Now, like there's a whole documentary about how he lost his mind making that movie. And this, you kind of feel like Soderbergh came out the other end going like, well, I'm just not going to do that again. You know, I'll just do stuff that is more enjoyable to shoot, that isn't in the jungle, maybe a little funnier, some more lighthearted stuff, and get myself back on track. So that's pretty much my final thought on it.
Tobin, any other?
You know, my only last thought is that I've really wrestled with this movie. Is during it I was wrestling with it, and afterwards I've been wrestling with it in our conversation. Like, I feel like maybe I would watch this again. I think what I would do first is read some good critics on it. There must be some critics out there who really champion it, who sort of are able to put it in some more perspective. Maybe it's just such a massive thing, it's hard to sort of wrap my brain around. And we've mentioned Twin Peaks: The Return in terms of its casting, the variety of roles, and so people walking on and off, and you expect them to have a lot to do, but also a sense of like, it's hard to sort of judge a thing or be critical about something till you can hold the whole thing in your brain somehow. And I don't feel like I'm holding this whole movie in my brain yet. And so maybe there's needs to be some reserving of judgment. If you're at all interested, I think it is worth watching. I think it does have this cumulative power. It does have these great performances in it, and some beautiful, beautiful shots. But I would urge people before they watch it to educate themselves, probably both about Che, the person, and Che, the movie. And I think that more context, I'm guessing, would help the viewing experience.
Because it's really not a movie you can spoil. It's just a movie that you can enrich by
right.
Knowing literally anything, which none of us did. So cool. Good job, guys.
None of us did. Right. No, that's a good way to put it. Yeah.
So for all things Cinemakers, you can go to cageclub.me or facebook.com/cageclub or at cageclubpod on Twitter. You can see all the episodes that we've done. You can see all of the other shows on our network, including that aforementioned boyfriend material. Maybe we'll have new... I mean, we're still releasing Cage and Keanu episodes. Maybe there's a new one of those out now in February. I don't know. That'd be exciting, right?
Very exciting.
There could have been like six Cage movies now in the past 3 months.
There's at least four or five between the time we're recording this and the time it's coming out, which is really like it's in advance, but it's not far enough in advance to warrant four or five movies. But you know, we're gonna take what we can get. So cageclub.me, facebook.com/cageclub, at cageclubpod on Twitter, or email us anything you want to say, mailbag@cageclub.me. I'm Joey Lewandowski.
I'm Mike Manzi.
And I am Tobin Addington.
And we'll see you next time on Cinemakers.